As you can hear from my accent, I'm originally from Germany, and more precisely from East Germany. I lived in East Germany all my life until the wall came down. This one-year exception, 1986-87, when I was an exchange person under the help of the Lutheran World Federation, came to the United States and ended my year in the United States with a one-month stay in Holden Village, which was really the best part of the visit, I have to say, and I'm glad that I'm back now after almost 8 years. I was a pastor, a Lutheran pastor in East Germany for a couple of years. I studied theology at the seminaries in Leipzig and East Berlin and got my PhD in 1986 from the University of Leipzig. I will be probably one of the very few people who hold a PhD in theology, and on the certificate there is a portrait of Karl Marx printed on. I don't think that many of these certificates exist. So I came in 1990, when Germany was united. I came back to the United States to teach at the Lutheran Seminary after a brief involvement in the transition government prior to unification. And I have taught before that for 1 year at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So I know quite a bit about the United States. I'm proud to have been in all 50 states, including Alaska and Hawaii. I probably plan to stay here for a while, since my family is American. Both my kids were born here, and my wife is Greek-American. And I teach at the seminary systematic theology, which is basically doctrine and ethics. We have two systematicians, and we share into the job, and we do not have a split into one person teaching doctrine and one person teaching ethics, but we both teach both. So part of my job is to teach people who prepare for the ministry in the Lutheran Church, either the ordained or the lay ministry, to teach ethics. And that's one thing I would like to discuss and talk with you in the next four sessions, if you have the time and the chance to visit all the sessions, to talk about a way that we can develop an ethics that is respectful and mindful of our own tradition, but also is aware and responsive to the challenges of a world that we live in, and particularly I would like to try that out in the field of environmental ethics, one of the great concerns that all of us share, that we need to develop a behavior in regard to the relation of humans to nature and to the environment that helps to make this planet a livable place for generations to come. So I'm going to do that in four steps. Today I would like to speak, and hopefully we can talk about what I call the crisis in moral behavior, that we seem to have lost a way to understand what is right and what is wrong in what we are doing. How come that is? What are ways to find a clear understanding of what is right and what is wrong? And then tomorrow, in the second step, I would like to talk about the different approaches in ethics and how ethics really works and how that could be applied to then environmental ethics. Then in a third step on Friday, there's no session on Thursday, on Friday, I would like to take a look at our tradition in regard to creation, the relation between humans and world, the relation between God and the world, and try to pose the question of whether our own tradition contributed to the situation in which we find ourselves in, and how we can utilize our tradition for reaching an approach to these issues that are helpful. And then in the fourth step, then I hope to be more precise in regard to how our tradition can help us to develop an environmental ethics. I think that all of these sessions are hopefully make sense in itself, so that you don't really have to come to all of them, or if you leave early and will miss the two, that it will still make sense to attend the first or the second session. But they are connected, and you will see that. I called the series World Out of Balance because I think that there are some indications that the balance of humans and the world and nature is somewhat out of sync. I don't know how long you have been here. I came 2 days ago, so I could watch the movie Waterworld, which I would not really recommend, because it's a fairly boring movie. I don't know if some of you have seen it. I really didn't enjoy it that much. But the theme, of course, is kind of interesting. The story idea behind the movie that through the greenhouse effect, the polar ice caps have been melting, and all the land is covered by water. We all know that is a real danger, particularly for the coastal regions of the continents. But there are more real disasters that we have faced in the last couple of years that made clear that things are not as much in balance as we would hope they are. The droughts in the United States, but also the droughts in Africa, the flooding in the Midwest, that's probably one of the issues that a lot of you who come from the Midwest had to deal with in the last couple of years, that are mainly man-made because of the development in the regions, the question of hurricanes, weather developments, and we feel more and more that something is wrong, and that something is out of balance. That has, of course, to do, I think, with a deeper knowledge about the connectedness of things. Certainly, natural disasters happened before, but we realize more now that a disaster has a reason. And by trying to find out the reason, we realize more that things that we do as humans contribute to that being out of balance. I think that we should not over-dramatize these changes. I think that throughout the history of the Earth, there have been dramatic changes in the environment of this planet. There was a loss of species over the whole development of life on Earth, and I would even say that if human beings will be a lost species in the future of this planet, that will not be the end of life and will not be the end of the world. You know that the saurians have vanished from the Earth before without end of life. So I think that it's quite important for us to realize that it is not only the whole Earth that is our concern, but ourselves. And I think that's one important rule already that we have to make quite clear when we think about environmental ethics. The whole term itself says already that something centrally human is involved here. It is not so much that we as benevolent people want to make sure that everything else survives, but we are dealing here with our own survival. And I think it is very important to make that clear to all of us, because then we begin to realize what is at stake for ourselves and why we should have an interest in these issues. It is not that we want to save the spotted owl, for example, to name one of the issues here in the Pacific West. That's really not the issue, but the issue is that our own survival is impacted when the world gets more and more out of balance. We have an interest, our identity and our culture is at stake. Only if we learn to balance our own interest with the interest of other things and other beings, then we might be able to keep the world in a balance that allows our own survival. So that's, I think, the core of the question of environmental ethics. And what I would like to ask in these couple of sessions is, do we as Christians have anything to contribute to that debate? As you all know, there are many people worried and concerned about these issues, but is there anything in our own heritage, in our own tradition, that would help us to contribute to the debate? And that is something that we want to explore in these next sessions. I think that in order to do that, in order to develop an environmental ethics that is sound and helpful, we have to go deeper than the question of what can we do right now. One of the big concerns of the ecological movement in the 70s and 80s was that they wanted to do something. And I think that was a great first step to raise awareness. You all know that Greenpeace and other organizations of that kind contributed greatly. I don't know if you are aware, as a little footnote here, that the opposition movement in Eastern Europe was mainly fueled by the environmental movement. That was really what got the opposition movement going, because when more and more people became aware of environmental and global issues, more people got involved. Not only intellectuals, but parents, grandparents who were concerned for the future of their children and grandchildren, overcame their anxieties and joined the movement, mainly for reasons of the environment. So that was a very important first step of getting people involved. But we are now at a stage where I think we have to ask deeper of what are the reasons for the situation in which we find ourselves. I'm afraid that sometimes we waste our energy and time in battles that do not bring us that far. There's one example that many of you might have heard about, the sinking of the Shell platform in the North Sea in Europe. There was a dramatic movement all over Western Europe. They boycotted Shell gas stations and so on to prevent an oil drilling platform in the North Sea to be sank in the sea. The problem with that is that it was celebrated now as a great victory when Shell finally decided not to sink the platform. The problem is that we are dealing here with a relatively minor problem. So a lot of energy and activism was focused on this one issue, while there were many other more urgent and dramatic issues that do not catch the attention because of this activism. Lynn White said in one of her articles about environmental ethics the following: unless we think about fundamentals, our specific measures may produce new backlashes more serious than those they are designed to remedy. So this idea that we have to think about fundamentals, that we have to understand of where does the situation come from? Why are we in this situation? What does it say about our own human nature is essential in order to take steps that are long-term oriented and not short-term oriented. One good example for that is the development of nuclear power, which was designed to address the energy problem. But as we know since Chernobyl, and I'm a person who was much more affected by Chernobyl than probably most of you, because I live very close by. I lived only a couple of hundred miles away from it, and we were told not to go outside and to not let the children play outside and stuff like that. The impact of nuclear power, of course, might have much more dramatic, serious consequences than the problem that it is designed to solve, the energy problem. So that's what I want to do with you in these four short sessions, to think more about fundamentals. And that might be frustrating for those of you who want to have more concrete answers, like what can I do tomorrow to save the environment? But I think it is time to step back from this question and think about more what are fundamental issues that we need to address when we look at the problems that we have to face in the new millennium. There is no question about that that there is an environmental crisis and that there is an identity crisis of humanity. And I think that that has reasons that are way beyond what might be problems of the day or of the year or of the decade. These are problems that go far beyond our own time, and we have to go back in history to understand what really brought this identity crisis of humanity. Sigmund Freud spoke of three major insults that brought the identity crisis of humanity and somewhat brought human beings out of balance with their own nature and their own identity. The first of these insults, he said, was the Copernicanian revolution, the awareness that we are not in the center of the universe, that we are not the center of everything, but that we are a rather insignificant, tiny little spot in the vast emptiness of the universe. Jacques Monod, a French biologist, has called it we are gypsies at the fringes of the universe. That was the first time the realization that that maybe the world and the cosmos is something beyond our own interests and our own existence, that we are relatively small and insignificant. And that, of course, was a grave insult to humanity that until then, over all the years of development, has thought that that they were the main focus of everything, including God. The second insult, then, Freud said, was the insult that Darwin has brought. Until then, we could still think that, well, maybe we are not in the center of everything, but at least we are better than everything. We are somehow different beings that are different from all the rest of the world. And then Darwin comes and says that we are just evolving creatures that have much more in common with the rest of nature than we think. It's not really, probably most people wouldn't regard it as a compliment, for example, that the closest our skin comes is the skin of a pig. We have very similar skins, and most people until today would regard that rather as an insult than as something that that is quite normal and have no problems with that. The idea that that we are basically part of the animal kingdom. And not really different from it, but coming out of it, maybe with a different focus and with different abilities, but not biologically being really different, was regarded as an insult and is regarded as an insult still in this country for many people. I mean, if I remember correctly, even in the 50s there were still legal fights about what can be taught in school, and I think that in recent years there's almost a backlash to that creationists want to reestablish what they would call biblical teachings, but which has actually relatively little to do with biblical teachings on the identity of humanity and the relation of humanity to the world. And then the third insult, Freud of course reserved for himself, the idea that human beings being in the middle of nowhere, being not better than anything else, are also not even in control of themselves. But what they think they are really not. They are controlled by their instincts and by their biological functions rather than by their will and by their ability to think. These three insults, which we almost take for granted today because we have lived with them for long, have to be understood as a really dramatic change of understanding human identity. I think we cannot understand deep enough how dramatic this change really was. And one of the problems that we have today, particularly when it comes to ethics, that we still operate ethics in an old-fashioned way. We try to utilize old sources, but we do not take into account these dramatic changes, and therefore it should not come as a surprise that some of the ethical models simply don't work anymore the way they worked in the past. I think that most people today, particularly in the American context, think that there is not only a crisis in the identity of human beings, but also a crisis in moral behavior, that people have forgotten what it means to act rightly and wrongly. They don't know anymore what is right and what is wrong. The world is more confusing today, and we have too many options that makes it hard to decide which road to take and what option to choose. One example for that that makes that quite obvious is the crime debate in the United States, which I found very disturbing. I come from a state, Pennsylvania, that has a new governor since last November. And the main focus of his campaign was the crime issue, and he got basically reelected by focusing on death penalty and solutions in regard to the crime. I don't know if that is really an issue in the Midwestern part of this country and in the Northwest. I know that it is in California, but in the East, in the big cities in the East, crime is one of the first issues that people raise when it comes to their concerns. There's almost an overreaction and hysteria, but there is certainly reason for concern. And I think that the crime, the problem with crime, has to do also with the problem of violence. That violence is more and more regarded as a solution to problems, and more important, a growing unawareness of guilt and responsibility. People don't know anymore what makes them responsible and what they are responsible for. There was a story in the Philadelphia Inquirer about a year ago about teenagers who had killed people. And not one of them acknowledged some kind of guilt or responsibility for what they have done. None of them was aware that they had done something wrong. But they always had some explanation why it was understandable what they did. The most bizarre case was a young Asian a doctoral student of Penn University of Pennsylvania who was killed, who was shot because he looked at somebody. And his murderer said, well, he looked at me. So, I mean, he deserved to die because you know that you don't do that, to stare at people. So that shows only that that there is an unawareness of guilt and responsibility. Also, the grab and run mentality, I think, is growing in this country, and I think that part of the disappointment of the political developments in recent years was that that what people had hoped with the Clinton administration, that there is a new, that there is a change of mentality in this country, has really not come through, and the backlash of the conservative right, I think, is understandable if you take into account this disappointment that the Clinton presidency didn't bring really this change in behavior, this change in attitudes that people had hoped for, and now they turn to different solutions, which I think are as unpromising as the Clinton proposals were. But this is also a global development. I remember very clearly that after the breakdown of the communist world, of the second world, a lot of people had hoped that the world would be a safer, a more harmonious place. George Bush spoke of the new world order, and this longing for order, I think, is very representative for the state of mind of people today. What we have now after 5 years is more chaos, more violence, more regional conflicts. If you look at places in Africa and in Europe, the breakdown of the competition between the first and the second world has actually created more chaos than solutions for the world situation. There's a growing nationalism and ethnic hatred in Bosnia. It's one example. Rwanda, Somalia are other examples. But even in the United States, there is a growing development for extremist ideologies. This time, particularly right-wing ideologies. The Oklahoma bombing is only the tip of an iceberg, I think. I have attended a couple of sessions in different places in the country about militia in Pennsylvania and Michigan and in other places, and most people are not even aware of what is going on the grassroots level in this society. And I think it is very important that that we realize what is going on as people who are concerned. We cannot deal with these issues without knowing what people really think and what they feel. It's nice to have a perfect solution for any questions that might exist, but if you don't really know what's going on in the mind of people, then all these solutions do not work. So what are the reasons for that development, for this, what I signs of that the world is becoming more and more out of balance? I think that that one of the reasons is that that we have this identity crisis of humanity, and I think that there are three steps that led into that identity crisis that help us to understand the depths of the problem. If you look at the Enlightenment, most prominence of French Revolution and the ideas that were brought about with that revolution, it had a very positive anthropology, a very positive understanding of human nature. Enlightenment was defined by Immanuel Kant as the liberation of humans from self-inflicted immaturity. So Enlightenment, with the Enlightenment came a very positive understanding of human beings that are able to liberate themselves, to begin to think for themselves, and to take their destiny in their own hands. Therefore, you speak of the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages as a time, that term was of course invented by Enlightenment, as a time when people were still not able to handle their own affairs, where they would put their trust in their religion or in other kinds of superstitious activities, but were not able to mature and take their destiny in their own hands.
Do you see us entering a new Dark Ages?
Well, I think that we are not only post-Enlightenment, but we are what people call the post-modernism. That is something like a Dark Age. I think that many people today want to go back to the Dark Ages and to their solutions, to superstition, to easy answers, to submitting themselves to higher authorities, and so on.
Anti-intellect.
Yes.
And anti-culture, maybe even.
Yes. And looking for a strong savior figure, whether it is Newt Gingrich or whether it is somebody else, to tell them what to do. I think that's the biggest problem, that people want somebody to tell them what to do. And when Clinton could convey to them that he might do that, they elected him, and now he didn't tell them what to do. He didn't actually know himself what to do. And now they look for somebody else. And it doesn't really matter who that person is and what the program of that person is, as long as the person poses him or herself as somebody who tells you what to do. So that's, in a way, an indication to kind of going back to the Dark Ages. So if we look at the Enlightenment, which I think is very strong, has a very strong influence on the culture of this country, much more than in Europe. This country comes out of Enlightenment. The positive anthropology, the positive understanding of human beings, is still very present in the culture, in the American culture. The idea that we can make it if we all pull together, if we just try very hard, we can manage things. That's the idea of Enlightenment. The post-Enlightenment situation, particularly in the 20th century, was caused, I think, by the world wars, particularly in Europe, and then also by the realization of the Holocaust. Many people regard that as one of the very strong impacts on the identity crisis of humanity, to realize what human beings can do to other human beings. The post-Enlightenment situation brought a totally negative understanding of humanity. Human beings are basically strangers or even evil people. The Camus novel The Stranger became one of the landmarks of this new era of existentialism, where basically people felt that the situation is pretty bad and we can do nothing about it. That was the situation of post-Enlightenment. Enlightenment was maybe the situation is not so bad and we can do something about it. But But both of these, the positive and the negative anthropology, the positive and the negative understanding of humanity, were still a point of orientation, and therefore did not bring the complete identity crisis. Even if you understand yourself as bad or as evil, that is something that is a point of orientation from which you can work. Now I think that postmodernism has neither a positive or a negative understanding of humanity, but an indifferent anthropology, which is quite different from the Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment. I think that is the core of postmodernism. Everybody speaks nowadays of postmodernism, but nobody really knows what it is. It's very often defined as something ending. Something is ending and we don't know what comes out of it and what might be a new beginning in it. I think that it can be best described as being indifferent. And if you look at the problems of our society that come up in this issue or in that issue, you can see that indifference might be a core of the problem. Indifferent anthropology doesn't know whether human beings are good or bad, and maybe don't even care whether they are good or bad. There is nothing that would determine human nature, whether it is positive or negative. And that means that you have a tendency to particularism, a tendency that you can clearly see that people cannot understand each other anymore, and therefore they withdraw to their own individualism or to their own group or to their own cultural setting. Something that you can clearly observe in Europe. It's almost absurd. For example, if you look at the situation in Yugoslavia, for example, Serbia and Croatia, there is really no difference between Serbians and Croatians. Even the language for a century was called Serbo-Croatian. It's the same language. The one is written in Cyrillic letters in the Russian alphabet, and the one is written in Latin letters, but they use the same words. But now all of a sudden, people feel that they need to distinguish themselves against the other, this tendency to particularism. I think that there is a growing tendency to racism in this country, that although most people agree that the civil rights movement was something very positive and important in this country, that there's a growing awareness that the races are different. I mean, the bell curve is only one example for that tendency, and that there's a kind of a going back from the idea of community and living together. I live in an integrated neighborhood in Philadelphia, and it has worked for over 30 years now, but there is a tendency now, even in Mount Airy, that white people move out and say, we don't want to live here anymore, that the schools are abandoned, that people try to find their salvation in the suburbs. And I think that's a tendency that you can observe all over the United States. Nothing universal is acceptable anymore. And as you can see there, I'm really not targeting one particular group or political spectrum here. It is something that affects all of us, whether you find yourself in the more liberal or in the more conservative camp, that there's a growing feeling that there is no universal truth, that there is only particular truth. And it's not worth even to try to find out something like a universal truth which would help us to bring us together. But rather people say, I accept whatever truth works for me, and I don't care if it works for you or if it is compatible with what you regard as truth. So what was the basic foundation for ethics in the time of the positive anthropology of enlightenment, and we talk about that a little bit more tomorrow, was a categorical imperative of Kant. You can do it. You ought to, because you can, because you ought to. And therefore, that was the basic ethical approach, that you can act morally because you are human. And in the post-Enlightenment era of existentialism, it was a despite. The ethical heroism that you can find in the novels of Albert Camus, in The Plague, for example, that you can act responsibly despite all the odds. Everything is against you, but despite that, you can still be human. In the postmodernism, there is, I think, a growing fear that you can't. Whether you ought to or whether it is despite, it doesn't matter, but you simply can't. It's kind of like giving up, throwing the towel and saying, there is no way, there is no way to deal with the situation for humans. Now, I think that the reaction that we need to find is that we have to regain a knowledge of what makes us human. That, in my opinion, is the key to the problem. We have to understand what makes us human in order to understand how we should act. All three, I think, optimism, the optimism of the Enlightenment, the pessimism of the post-Enlightenment, and the indifference of the postmodern world have led deeper into the crisis. And the way to deal with it now is to step back and see what can we realistically say about ourselves. What can we say about human nature that can serve as a foundation of ethics? I think that here in our tradition, in our Christian tradition, there are things that would help us to develop that realistic anthropology. An anthropology that is not overly optimistic about what we can do, that is not overly pessimistic about what we cannot do, but that is also not indifferent about our possible action. And that I find in the Judeo-Christian anthropology of the biblical text of Genesis 1 and 2, in which there is, it's very fascinating to me, and I talk about that on Friday, that we have two creation stories that are already creating a balance. It's not only one. The truth can never be told only in one story. You have to have at least two. And to keep the balance, because if you have only one, then you cannot have a balance. And if you look at these two creation stories, and the one, human beings are called the crown of creation, the image of God. That's a very positive anthropology. And then you have in Genesis 2 and 3, almost a negative anthropology, the human beings that cannot survive in the paradise for a couple of hours without falling. Actually, little footnote here, Martin Luther thought that the fall happened about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, because because that's nap time, you know, and you are not as fully aware of what you are doing. So be aware of the 2 o'clock hours. So you have that balance here about a positive and a negative anthropology that together, I think, provide us with a realistic anthropology. To demask the evil must not, I think, end in the condemnation of the wrongdoer. So I don't think that the job is to point at the wrongdoer That's unfortunately a tendency that we very often give in to, that we say, okay, this particular group or this particular idea is doing things wrong. But we still have to acknowledge and understand the evil that surrounds us and that threatens our nature in order to understand how we can deal and live with it. And on the other hand, the focus on the goodness of humanity in a positive anthropology must not end in a naive feeling that we just have to try very hard and bring out the best in us and then every problem will be solved. I have also a couple of pages on sociological reasons for the world being out of balance that I could go into. I look at my watch. We have about 12 minutes left. I would rather stop here for a moment and ask you to react and comment on what you heard so far, and give you a chance to raise some of the concerns that you have or ask questions. Go ahead.
Since some of the reasons for some of this postmodernism breakdown is the Cold War, mm-hmm. we spent 50 years where the only real intellectual thought was communism versus anti-communism. Mm-hmm. Any subtleties beyond that seemed not to concern people. Mm-hmm. So if your foreign policy was defined not in terms of, as John Kennedy, I think, once said, you know, he's our SOB, not their SOB, when it came to determining who we supported and who we didn't, mm-hmm. so that granularity was lost. And now that the Cold War is over, there's this huge vacuum. Mm-hmm. And it's made all the worse because we've had 50 years of sloppy thinking. Mm-hmm. And we find, I believe, that we've got leaders or spokespersons on almost any issue, none of whom I find have any credibility. I find, for instance, Greenpeace is right on some things, but they tend to exaggerate to an extent that loses all credibility with me. Mm-hmm. I find the political right has some things going for them. Yes, there was a breakdown in morality, the teaching of ethics, the living of an ethical life. But they carried it so far that I can't believe them either. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just, that's sort of one thing.
Yeah, I think that the problem of the Cold War thinking is not so much only a political one, but the tendency to think black and white, mm-hmm. to categorize everything into the good guys and the bad guys, which I think is very strong, particularly in the American culture. I don't find it as strong in the Western European culture, partly because they had much more contact with the so-called evil empire and knew that things are never as black and white as you might want. And this is a tendency that I also observe, and here again, both on the right and the left, that we try to categorize the other as the bad guys, and we are the good guys. And I think that is one of the key issues that will influence the political situation and the societal situation in the United States in the next 20 years, that we have to overcome that thinking. And I think that that liberals would not be very well advised to condemn everything that comes out of this conservative movement that has developed, particularly since last November. If we don't take the concerns of the people that express themselves in these elections seriously, we will not be very helpful in what we have to say. So I think we have to overcome this polarity thinking, this black and white thinking, and take what is useful from wherever we can get it. You wanted
I think
to
that's why your comment about the return to fundamentals is important, because too often, especially here in the Northwest, we look at like it's either a poor starving logging family or owls. Mm-hmm. That's the choice that we're faced with and that we seem to discuss all the time.
Yes.
But I think that's begging the issue.
Right.
And I think there are a lot of issues, as you say, that are not necessarily black and white or are being presented in a faulty way, faulty thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to get beyond that and back to the fundamentals of creation, of where we stand as Christians in the world and how we view the world, rather than debating these things that are thrown out in that way.
Uh-huh. But you can almost become a mediator. I mean, you can be the peacemaker as a Christian. I mean, I found that's a difficult arena, but it's one that really, I think, fits Christian thinking. That rather than being political, you're working toward, we're making progress. I mean, there are extremists on this side, extremists on this, but we're making progress. But you need to have people who are right in the middle of it, maybe, but who are willing to be in the thick of it and to discuss mm-hmm. and to make the necessary, take those necessary steps, make those necessary agreements to get progress.
I think that's true. I think you have to be able to have the fundamentals to be able to step in the middle and come to some working together, or else you end up being a mushy middle that, oh yeah, I can hear things on both sides, and it's cool.
I think that was part of the problem of the Clinton administration, that they gave the impression that that they didn't take a stand. And I think that was very unfortunate, because I think that there is to take a middle way to avoid extremes must not necessarily mean that you don't have an opinion or that you don't know. You can very clearly state what you think is right and what you think is wrong, but you can state it in a way that is not confrontational, but that is acceptable for the side that you are talking about. And I think that's the most important rule in peace negotiation. It doesn't help to tell you that you are that you have done something wrong. If you are not able to accept that, then it doesn't help at all to bring that into the debate. And one interesting experience of my own life was that Christians in Eastern Europe, for a very short amount of time, were able to do exactly that, to be that credible source of trust that all sides, that even the communists, I mean, that was really fascinating, that the communists, who regarded us as their enemies for these 40 years, were coming to us and saying, after the experience that they had with Christians over 40 years, that you are, they were coming and telling us, you are able to get us out of here without any dramatic chaos, because we know that you will not just take sides, but you will help people to come together. So I think that is a very important experience that Christian can learn from, to take this place of negotiator. And I think that's something that we need in this country very urgently too. Well, some of that I wanted to. That was my next point, and I hope that I can get to it tomorrow. But one of the fascinating things that I experienced over the last couple of years is I travel a lot, and I was this June in Sulawesi, very remote island in Indonesia, and I finally reached a village which was fairly cut off from the rest of society and from the rest of the world and so on. But people there who lived basically hundreds of years ago, the same rites and so on, but one thing was very modern about themselves. I don't know if modern is the right word. They were all drinking Coca-Cola. It's really amazing if you travel a lot that Coca-Cola is everywhere in the world. And I think that, that is a very important point, that that there is this globalization. I mean, the politicians today, you know, are talking about trade surplus and Japan being too influential and so on. But what's going on in the business world is already way beyond that. Japanese are producing here, Americans are producing in Thailand and so on. Look at the labels of the clothes that you're wearing. So that is something that more and more people have control, less and less people have control over. And I think that that is certainly one of the big problems that we have to face in the next century, that that less and less people can really make a decision about what the environment or what the economy or whatever can the direction it can go to. Because the decisions are made relatively remote from the people, and I think part of that is also that there's a tendency to individualizing consumerism, that whatever matters, the basic values of life become certain consummation of certain products, and of course that. Exactly.
Or even replaced by the marketplace.
Yeah. So that means then that if you speak if you relate that to the identity crisis, that people tend more and more to find their identity not in or out of themselves, but rather in something alien to themselves, a product, for example, drinking Coca-Cola or wearing Levi's jeans or something like that. But that's a problem. I mean, we have to talk about that more.